Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 164. Remember when we left off, we'd been hearing about the squad of Royal Engineers who'd crossed into Amaxhosa territory over the Tumi River, January 1846, the date. They were led by Lieutenant J. Stokes. This small team of five were surveying land for the site of a new fort. Little did they know that their crossing of Block Drift into Nika country was a small initial skirmish that was going to lead to a very large war. Some say war was coming anyway. However, their blatant trespass definitely applied the Amaxhosa chief's minds, as you're going to hear. They'd crossed over from the ceded territory, where forts were allowed, into Xhosa territory, where forts definitely were not. And why they did this has been debated since. Conservative preacher Henry Calderwood, if you remember, had also been so shocked by the news, he wrote a letter of warning to the Cape governor about this umbrage. Chief Mgolobani Sandile of the Rarabi was under pressure from the other chiefs and his young warriors. Of course, Sandile had been thrown into his role almost a decade earlier and faced crisis after crisis. His older brother, Makoma, despised him, no, worse, hated him, and mainly for his superior rank. Sandile was no fool. His speeches had been written down and proved he was an agile thinker and a determined policymaker, and had full consultation with another brother, Anta, and a wise counsellor called Tyala. The latter lived near Sandile at the Burns Hill Mission Station. There was an obvious and steady march to war once more on the Eastern Cape frontier. The elder, Tyala, whose father had lived near Block Drift, was now openly counselling for war. 6 days after Calderwood's letter was sent to Cape Town, Sandile made his move. There's some proof that Sandile confidentially gave his permission for this small group of British soldiers to actually enter his land, but apparently believed they were just visiting, they were not going to survey for a fort. So Sandile decided to go and visit the engineers himself to see what they were up to. A lot has been made of this visit. He arrived with a full war party and was aggressive. It so happened that shortly before he set off, he'd received a letter from the English administrator of the ceded territory, Charles Lennox Stretch, who was based in Fort Beaufort. It was a letter of complaint about cattle theft and about an incident where Sandile had slapped an English trader who'd insulted him, then taken his goods from his shop without paying. Sandile sent his reply saying that both the governor of the Cape, Sir Peregrine Maitland, and Lennox Stretch were rascals and that the traders were under his feet as chief, in his words, and he'd do what he liked with them, and those who complained about cattle theft should shut up. It was in this dark mood that Sandile arrived at Block Drift, at the site of the proposed fort. The five British soldiers in the survey camp were shaken by his attitude, and Lieutenant Stokes sent an urgent message to Fort Beaufort for reinforcements. Stretch sent his own urgent message to Lieutenant Governor John Hare in Grahamstown, who immediately gathered a company of 100 British troops along with a cannon and set off for Block Drift. Sandile met the Lieutenant Governor when the force arrived. Hare had decided that Sandile was going to apologize for insulting the governor and for what the Englishman called the Amaxhosa chief's insolence. That was not all. When Hare arrived at Block Drift, he was stunned to see around 3,000 Amaxhosa warriors lined up and ready for action. What Hare didn't know was that there were another 1,500 warriors hiding in nearby bush. Had he decided to attack then and there, all military historians agree, Hare and his force would have been wiped out like General Custer at Bighorn. It was clear now that he couldn't seize Sandile, so the two palavered. That was his original plan, to seize the Amaxhosa chief. As they did this palavering, thousands of Amaxhosa warriors began a series of manoeuvres which amounted to an obvious attempt at encircling the British troops. The British soldiers extended their line to try and avoid being outflanked. While all of this was going on, Hare and Sandile palavered. "That tent, which there is at Block Drift, must be off tomorrow," demanded Sandile. Hare responded angrily, saying no one would tell him what to do, and a military confrontation appeared inevitable. Neither Hare nor Sandile, however, wanted to fight at Block Drift. They were nervous of each other's aims. Sandile had believed he was going to be kidnapped by the British, who were notorious for breaking their word about these sorts of things. He was right to be suspicious. Hare was going to arrest him, despite sending notice he would not. Hare, in turn, realized his fate now hung in the balance. Even with his firepower, he faced insurmountable odds, and it was likely that if the shooting began, his entire force would be wiped out. What was also different from previous engagements is that the Amakhosa were now armed with muskets, hundreds of muskets. These sons of Rarabi had come with powder and ball, albeit somewhat antiquated weapons, they were still firearms. Each party was sufficiently daunted by the other to be accommodating, as John Lebund points out in his great historical work, The Land Wars. Sandile then apologized for calling Hare and others rascals, and Hare accepted the apology. But the chief of the Rarabi refused to compensate settlers for cattle theft and insisted that he could take what he liked from the traders inside his territory. This was inside the ceded territory, contested land, that part of southern Africa that had caused conflict for two generations, and the Rarabi traditional land. After hours of palavering, the Amakhosa chief withdrew for the night, agreeing that negotiations would continue on the morrow. As they left, the warriors fired departing shots over the British soldiers' heads. The next day, Hare relented and told Sandile that the Royal Engineers would be withdrawn back west of the Tumi River. They had finished their work anyway. The two leaders shook hands, and the British soldiers turned and marched back across Block Drift, heading to Grahamstown. This meeting resolved nothing, but proved that the Amakhosa were fixing for a fight. The basic issue of who ruled the ceded territory remained unaddressed. Back in Grahamstown, the journal's editor and communicator of All Things Settler railed against Sandile. Robert Godlinton demanded action, pressing for the full annexation of the ceded territory. But he didn't stop there. There was a second frontier region called the Province of Queen Adelaide that also had been handed back to the Amakhosa, and Godlinton and the English farmers around the Albany district had been eyeing this valuable land for some time. Godlinton said both territories had to be seized. The Amakhosa were not using it properly. This is an established narrative here in South Africa. I'm sure you recognize it. Sitting back in Cape Town, sipping his excellent Groendryf or Semillon-based wine, perhaps a bit of good brandy or muscatel, was His Excellency, Governor Sir Peregrine Maitland. What kind of response was required? He mused. By now, you know that Maitland was a Peninsula veteran, that he had lived in Upper Canada, and was steeped in military tradition. When he received the latest Block Drift report, he began to seriously consider a preemptive military strike against Amakhosa, and to settle this matter once and for all. He was also peeved about Hare giving ground. British soldiers don't withdraw when faced by savages, he thought. This was a demonstration of weakness. Maitland ordered 200 men of the 27th Regiment, known as the Inniskillings, to board two ships and sail to Algoa Bay from Cape Town immediately. They landed within a few days and marched straight for the ceded territory to Fort Beaufort. Sandile and Mother Sutu, who were living nearby on the slopes of the Amatola Mountains, fled ahead of this force into the rolling and picturesque peaks, always a sanctuary in the ongoing conflict between settler and Xhosa. No war had been declared yet, but tension was as tight as the strings on Rafael Nadal's tennis racket. 55 pounds of tension, I'm reliably informed. A darkness seemed to hang over the region through that February, the traditional month of thunderstorms that cracked open the skies and mirrored the sentiment of both Amakhosa and settler. This year was dry despite these flashing storms. Little rain had fallen, increasing the sense of foreboding. For the Amakhosa, this constant threat of an invasion of their land appeared to be attached to a genocidal intent. The land rooted their ways, and the settlers had made it clear that they wanted nothing to do with the Xhosa culture. Their ancient way of life was anathema to these new arrivals from Europe. As with other ideas of the globe, the immigrants were encroaching not only on territory, but on the very idea of autochthonous survival. The colonists were holding angry meetings in places like Graaf-Reinet, Uitenhage, Grahamstown, Fort Beaufort, where the sentiment was directed against the Amakhosa, not just as a threat, but as a people. The settlers wanted the Amakhosa expunged from the land, sent hither, men, women, and children. Yes, Then they could come back and work inside these territories as serfs, laborers, said people like Godlinton, who wrote about taking the land through military means because the immigrants believed it was wasted on the Amaxhosa. It was time to attack these heathens, he said, to show them their proper position and cause them to respect the power of the British government. Lieutenant Governor Hare didn't help matters. He was flip-flopping like a new landed bream on a fisherman's pontoon. The settlers lampooned Hare, regarded him as a limp-wristed weakling. He turned into an object of derision and hate. Incompetent! These same settlers appeared oblivious to the fact that Hare, in Grahamstown, was actually a bulwark against the Amaxhosa chiefs running roughshod over their farms and retaking Albany. Yes, they laughed at his wishy-washy ways. In February 1846, he issued an order for his army to prepare for action, then, barely 2 days later, rescinded the order, saying, no, there was no cause for alarm. All these fears and loathings were focused in the minds of a particular group of farmers, the sheep farmers. They were on the edge of the frontier and in the most danger when it came to any war breaking out. One of these was our old friend John Mitford Bowker, who described depredations at the hands of Amaxhosa rustlers. He could no longer farm cattle. His horses were stolen, along with his oxen he retained for pulling his wagons. And this is frontier life, he said. The anxieties, the watchings, searchings, listenings, dog barkings, etc. I cannot describe, neither can you wholly conceive, he was to say at a speech later that year. This is the life that destroyed the loyalty of the Boers and is ruining as fine a country as any under the crown. It is precisely that sentiment, dear listener, that was being repeated across the British Empire by tens of thousands of immigrants who went from the industrializing Great Britain to lands like New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, Patagonia, Canada, the frontiers of the United States, even Hong Kong and Malaysia. This was at the heart of the dilemma of the systematic colonization helping create and sustain the empire itself. Back at the colonial office, they were much more pragmatic than the global settler clans. If men will settle in the neighborhood of marauding tribes, muttered James Stephen at the colonial office, they cannot, I think, claim that at the national expense they should be rescued from the natural penalty of that improvidence, any more than vine dressers and farmers at the foot of Vesuvius can expect indemnity against the effects of an eruption. Well, somewhat callous, you may say. It was, after all, Great Britain who had sent these English settlers into the heart of Albany, failing to warn them of the dangers of the frontier, pretending it was all safe and sound, pretending that the land was empty. Well, in reality, it had been stolen from the Amaxhosa chiefs under pain of death and musket. Bowker had a response to Stephen, by the way, and one which was proven accurate later, when South Africa's mineral riches emerged in full glory. Oh, had there been rupees and silver amongst the blacks, what willing help we should have had to quell their impudence and teach them to fear and respect us. Because the frontier cost so much with no reward, the colonial office regarded the Eastern Cape as a basket case. It was here that the groundswell for self-rule began to germinate more effectively, and then across the empire. For whether it was Australia or South Africa or Canada, settlers around the world believed that colonial policy and missionary zeal was the actual cause of the problem, not their presence on the land. As savages, they are unfit to occupy any higher station. Their land must be taken, sold, and settled, and they must be taught to earn their living in an honest, industrious way, John Mitford Bowker announced at the same speech in Grahamstown. The settlers believed it was the colonial office tethered to some kind of post-slavery humanitarianism that was to blame. This, of course, was expressed in the face of the logic of the frontier. It was a full, powerful British military presence that presented the clearest common ground between the empire and the people like Bowker and Godlinton, and even the missionaries. The missionaries, however, mostly followed a narrative that a strong military would protect the Amaxhosa against the settlers. It's curious, isn't it, this ironic ripple of history. Without a strong and impartial army in the way on the frontier, few believed in any prospect of lasting peace. And that would not happen because an army is very expensive, and English voters of the time would never agree to paying for this adventurism of their brethren in Africa and Australia et al. So right now, some Amakosa chiefs were aware of the momentum. Take Makoma, one of the gifted Amakosa military commanders, who'd been feuding with his brother Sandile, as I said. On the 23rd of February 1846, Makoma asked Lieutenant Governor John Hare for permission to settle inside the colony, inside Albany, or at least on the western side of the ceded territory. He wanted, he said, to avoid violence when hostilities began. No way, said Hare. This was a great error, missionary Calderwood said later. For whatever Macoma's motives were, his absence would have seriously weakened the war party. Macoma has much influence and great activity in war. Yes, you can say that hindsight is all very well, but Calderwood asked Hare at the time to allow this highly experienced war leader to move closer to the British just to break up Rarabi power base. It was ironic, because later it was Macoma's tactical brilliance that was going to lead to an embarrassing and bloody defeat for the British, and that was going to take place in a few months. But I'll get back to that next episode. Now, we turn to the spark that set the Eastern Cape alight. It involved the matter of a man called Tsili and what appeared to be an axe stolen from a shop in Fort Beaufort. That Tsili stole the axe has not been disputed. It's what happened afterwards that led to the War of the Axe, or the War of the Boundary, depending on your point of view. The Imadangi clan lived across the border from Fort Beaufort and were ruled over by Nkosi Botomani. One of his headmen was Tola, a notorious border bandit. The authorities had numerous run-ins with Tola. The next was going to be much more serious than searching for stolen cattle from a settler farm. Fort Beaufort was the headquarters of the 7th Dragoon Guards, who had spent much of the time hurrying up and doing nothing in military tradition. Dragoon Guards found it all a dreadful bore. On the 16th of March, 1846, their boredom was going to be broken by the theft of the aforementioned axe. Tsili was duly arrested for the theft and then sent with a small Cape Coloured Mounted Rifles escort to stand trial in Grahamstown, handcuffed to a Khoisan fellow prisoner. Tola, the bandit, or freedom fighter, you pick your point of view, set up an ambush joined by members of the Imadangi clan. The escort was held up by men with muskets. Then to release Tsili from his handcuffs, Tola hacked off the Khoisan prisoner's hand, then threw the poor man into a nearby river where he bled to death. Upon hearing about all of this, Lieutenant Governor Hare ordered Imadangi chief Nkosi Botomani to hand over both Tola and Tsili to face justice for the Khoisan prisoner's death, as well as for the theft of the axe. When Botomani refused, Hare sent a note up to the Amakosa chain of command straight to Rarabi chief Sandile to deliver up the killers, but he refused as well. With the clamour of the settlers in his ears, the clamour of the bored officers of the 7th Dragoons, and the clamour of the relatives of the dead prisoner, Hare decided to march into Emakosini to exact revenge or justice. Back in Cape Town, Governor Maitland spent very little time wondering about all of this and backed up Hare's announcement with a full declaration of war on the 1st of April 1846 against Amakosa. April Fool's Day. Things were shaky globally. Within a few weeks, the Eastern Cape wouldn't be alone in the drift to war. A momentous war was going to break out on April 25th, 1846, known as the Mexican-American War. Momentous because it was all about who owned Texas. In that war, the American army invaded Mexico following the annexation of Texas, which Mexico said was its territory. We don't have time to plunge into that shark-filled geopolitical tank, but it goes to show just how all these frontier conflicts were now turning into full-blown wars. Unlike the previous war, where the Amakosa had invaded the colony without warning, this time it was the British who initiated hostilities and invaded Amakosa territory. They were not marching alone. Joining them would be thousands of Amakosa warriors who were intent on revenge for a few wrongs, at least in their eyes, caused by Sandile. For the refugees, the Amamfengu, this was an opportunity. Governor de Urban's plan a decade earlier had been for the Amamfengu to settle in the ceded territory, but when it was handed back to the Amakosa, they were chased out, living in the stubby Thornveld around Fort Petty since. That embittered the Amamfengu, who had loved the fertile valleys of the Tumi and Khakha rivers and the rolling hills of the Amatolas. Some Amamfengu had found themselves in the Tsitsikamma forest where fevers had killed off most of their cattle. The Amakosa knew that they'd be fighting British soldiers and black warriors. Of all the chiefs, part of the Qunuqwebe suffered most from the presence of the Mamfengu. When these refugees had arrived, Patu had welcomed them. He had supported the British against the Amaxhosa in earlier wars, but he had faced an internal ruction over the Europeans' ways. Patu, by the way, was an interesting man, another of these characters of history that deserves a bit more visibility. He attended church while never converting to Christianity and tried to send his son to a private school in the Cape Colony. It was matters concerning his younger brother Karma that turned him against the British. Karma became a full convert and then embarrassed his chiefly brother Patu by refusing to take a second Amamtembu wife. He had made his decision about polygamy and he was against it. When these differences blew up, Karma wanted to gain his independence to move away from Patu. Theophilus Shepstone, who was going to become so crucial in Natal, particularly during the Zulu War of 1879, had advised Karma to take his supporters north away from Patu, his brother. Then Hare announced the land that Karma had vacated was going to be handed over to the Amamfengu. Patu was very cross about that. He was going to cause the British a great deal of pain in the coming war because of all these shenanigans. What happened next is for next episode. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. It elevates visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog. I'm going to have a little update about the episode. You can also contact me through there. Until next, goodbye.